Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend's edition. Also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, the KE Report. We featured a lot of companies again this week and also covered some of the market moves. But for this weekend show, we're really going to take a step back and focus more on the resource sector, since a lot of our commentators, a lot of the people we talk to on a regular basis, just got back from at least one, if not a few, of the conferences in Colorado over the last couple weeks. I think it's important to touch base with all these people, get their takes on the overall market sentiment, which we all know is not great still. And if they see any opportunities in these generally just depressed stock prices. We're kicking off the show with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Now, Joe, just a quick conference recap of the Beaver Creek Conference. I know you had a lot of meetings with companies just as we did. Your takeaways, please, from the general state of the markets, especially when it comes to these more junior and mid-sized companies that are at Beaver Creek.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, guys. Yeah, I was at Beaver Creek and, you know, the attendance was pretty good. But some people remarked that, you know, it was a bit of an echo chamber. Everybody, you know, was glad to see everybody, that sort of thing. But in terms of meetings, there were investor meetings, but most of those investor meetings were from current investors, not a lot of new people coming. And then the other meetings were either, you know, analysts, newsletter writers, or corporates. And you know, the amount of corporates attending Beaver Creek has been increasing. And so there was a lot of meetings like that. And on the financing part, probably a lot of companies were taking meetings from royalty companies as well, as they've been on the hunt, you know, to provide, you know, equity or financing for an option on a royalty. You know, otherwise, I mean, the sentiment was, I mean, we, you know, out of it, we'll usually see a lot of news and, you know, financing transactions. The biggest one was probably the $70 million, you know, without the green shoe, bought deal for Reunion Gold, a large open pit resource in Guyana. But otherwise, you know, not a lot of news coming out between the gold show and Beaver Creek.
Well, Joe, it was interesting because sitting in these meetings, you're spot on. Like a lot of these companies told us that when they talked to retail, it was just kind of churning through the same people trading amongst themselves, investors they already knew. But there was a lot more corporates there. There was some mid-tier and major companies meeting with companies. There were some capital markets guys. But to your point about the royalty companies, there was a lot of them meeting with companies offering financing to maybe advance a development project further or get to a key study or something along those lines. What do you make of the rise of royalty companies' popularity with these companies where a couple of years ago they would have shunned them away?
I mean, that's probably a very easy answer, is that, you know, the financing opportunity for a lot of these juniors, especially precious metals explorers and developers, was a lot better, you know, up to the first quarter of this year. So probably the royalty companies were being shunned at that point. But right now, you know, the retail sector is really not there, especially in Canada, that it's harder for them to find the money to keep their exploration programs going or, you know, to do technical reports or continuing their permitting activities, such that royalties become selling a royalty becomes an option because, you know, the equity is, you know, a fraction of what you think it's worth, you know, which reflects badly on the asset value. But a royalty is sometimes worth more, and that's something you can get cash for. So definitely the royalty companies are back with a vengeance, and those that are cash flowing with significant treasuries, this is definitely their market.
Yeah, it really just comes down to the fact that there isn't that much money out there for companies. My biggest takeaway is that the cash is king, and it has been for a while, but if you don't have money, boy, oh boy, there are not many companies out there that can fund really anything, even just keeping the lights on, which maybe isn't the worst thing considering how many companies there are. But Joe, if we do see more royalty transactions, more streams on advanced assets, does that shy bigger companies away from M&A action?
Yes, I would say that especially the streaming of the main product, like on a gold project, that would definitely be abhorrent to any kind of M&A. But you just got to know that usually if somebody does that in a decent market, that's a reflection of the asset. Right now, I don't know if that's an absolute reflection of the asset or more of a reflection of management basically succumbing to, the realization they can't get money anywhere else. And they still want to build the project in the timeline that they have. You know, they've given up and thrown in the towel with respect to that. But in terms of the royalty, you can still do a royalty as long as you keep the overall royalty, manageable. You could still attract M&A. You know, my example would be Liberty Gold, which we have in the portfolio and Exploration Insights. They did a deal where they, just basically moved cash from Wheaton, bought a royalty, which was only 0.5% from a local vendor. Wheaton acquired that royalty, cash in, cash out of about, I don't know, it was like $3.5 million. But the option for Liberty and potentially their suitors is that they can buy that royalty down by 50%, take it from 0.5% to 0.25%. Which they didn't have that option with the private vendor. So for me, with Liberty, that's a bonus. But again, no cash traded hands. Liberty didn't increase their treasury. But that gave them the option of doing a private placement with Wheaton, which they did, and raised $5 million in the market, which they probably couldn't have normally, with no warrants, with Wheaton taking about 5 of the $5.3 million. So that ended up being a good thing for them.
Well, Joe, another theme that came out of a lot of these meetings was that when they were trying to do their capital stack, in addition to debt, equity, and royalties, a lot of companies were considering a JV partnership or bringing in a strategic partner where maybe they take on the 9.9% or 19% interest. Some of them were worried that they actually may come in with a 50-50 interest and were trying to defend against that because they've done so much work on these projects. They didn't want to see all that given up, half the project to another major, but some of them are out of options. What do you make of the market for the JVs and the strategic partnerships?
Well, I always thought a good joint venture model was the way Gold Road did their development project in Western Australia with Goldfields. And Goldfields did something similar with Osisko on their windfall project. It was a 50-50 joint venture, and their payment into the joint venture basically covered the capital required by the company to develop, to pay into their 50-50 pro rata. That was a good arrangement in that the company didn't have to build out a team with respect to, a development team and an operating team. They didn't have to dilute, their share count. And, the project goes into production with the know-how and the expertise of the major. It's 50-50, you're cash flowing, and you can continue to explore and develop other projects in your portfolio while a major is taking care of the project. So I think that that's not a bad deal for companies. Gold Road did it and Osisko did it. So, I don't see that's a bad thing. And some people might prefer it to, you getting a 30% premium off a 52-week low and, that's it, you walk away. This way, you still have leverage to the asset. And if you believe precious metals are going to turn around, you still have leverage to that.
And this whole narrative here, Joe, of companies looking for JVs or partnerships, going to the royalty and streaming companies, even offloading non-core assets, to me, it just screams of kind of bear market action. Companies are out there trying to generate whatever kind of money they can, whatever interest they can, and hope that they can actually still keep the lights on moving into next year. That being said, this all kind of ties into development plays. And I know you focus a lot on development plays. There are what seem like quite a few assets out there all around the world that have economic studies that show they can make money at metals prices that are generally lower than where gold is now. However, a lot of these economic studies have also bumped up their baseline case to around $1,800 gold. how do you filter out which development plays are going to get built, which projects actually have a chance of getting moved forward, rather than just kind of sitting dormant and seeing a company redo economic study after economic study?
Well, I think the you know, now as the industry has whatever evolved, you know, there's fewer suitors. There's because a lot of the majors have consolidated, and you know, this next big consolidation is Newmont and Newcrest, and that's going to probably involve a lot of divestments. So you'll see more projects come into the market, but I don't know if the market is there where they can absorb them, where you know people can raise capital and actually buy those projects in the current market. So we're going to see more projects actually come into the development space, especially with precious, you know, given the Newmont Newcrest merger. I think the suitor is going to be the important part of the M&A equation, because it's what the suitor wants. And what I see, because of a lot of the geopolitical issues globally, whether it's creeping nationalism, you know, the problems in the African Sahel with, security issues from terrorism and all that sort of stuff. Geopolitical risk is going to be a bigger deal. So if you're in a place, if your asset is a decent asset in a political geopolitical jurisdiction where a suitor needs more exposure to, then you might have, you know, an asset worth having. So, I mean, I was in Nevada. I was visiting i80 Gold, which is a company we hold in the letter as well. And their sort of exploration development project, their opportunity there for a potential suitor is they own an autoclave, and they don't own an autoclave, you know, that can process refractory gold in the middle of nowhere. It's right on the highway. It's literally on Highway I-80. And they're trying to build up three different underground projects to feed it. And so for any upcoming suitor that wants exposure to Nevada and doesn't have to talk to Nevada gold mines to, you know, basically run their material through them, because the toll milling arrangements will be onerous, that's the comparative advantage I see. But it's not a great market for development projects usually, and now it's even less. So not only are they trying to keep the lights on, but more so they're trying to progress in this market, advance these projects permitting. So they burn a lot of cash. And so what they've had to do in the interim, they did an equity placement earlier this year, but they sold gold forward to Orion Mine Finance, because they are producing from one of their underground mines, but processing it with Nevada Gold Mines under a more favorable term. So even those companies are having issues trying to find money.
Well, maybe just one more on the M&A theme, Joe, and that is that a lot of these companies that we've seen, the big boys acquiring the big boys, have been waiting and waiting for someone to take them out, maybe since last cycle and then again this cycle. So we've seen a lot of development companies just kind of trotting along, maybe expanding their resources, maybe trying to find a high grade open pit, starter pit to boost the economics or maybe lower the capex on the front end. But it seems like there's a lot of mid tiers out there that have not been very active. And while everybody pins their hope on the majors, there's dozens of mid tiers that can actually bolt on either small single asset producing mines or some of these development stage companies, similar to what we saw with B2 Gold taking over Sabina, Orla taking over Gold Standard Ventures. Do you think we'll see more deals like that where the mid tiers come down into the space and get a little more active?
Yes, that's more so what I'm hoping for. And hope is not a great strategy, but it might be the only one we have right now. So the thing about the mid tiers is their ability to consume a project and go through a capital cycle is more, you know, engaging for them. Let's say that they have, it's totally absorbing. Like take, for example, Equinox Gold. They bought Premier Gold for their Hard Rock Gold project, you know, which on 100% is about 5 million ounces that they want to produce over 14 years or something like that. So it's a big project. It's in Northern Ontario, open pit, I'm not sure, 1.4, 1.5 grams per ton. They're basically saying that they're on budget, on time, which has been something that those projects haven't been able to deliver. But they've had to do basically a convertible debenture to help fund, to refinance their debt, as well to keep the project running so they can get into commercial production by 2024. Those kind of companies, you'd have to look at each individual suitor to know their own individual capital cycle, to know, are they finished their capital cycle and are they ready with their treasury to absorb more growth? Or are they in the middle of a growth project right now such that they can't absorb another one? So you'd have to look at each individual profile to know where they are in their own individual capital cycle, because they don't have as big of a diversified portfolio to handle another, let's say, billion-dollar development project.
Okay, so I feel like we're talking a lot about precious metal stocks here. What about critical minerals? Because, look, I'm still seeing a bit more interest in critical mineral companies, even though a lot of the stock prices have pulled back a little bit. But quite frankly, it also looks like there are more options for some of these critical mineral companies to generate some cash to move their projects forward. Your outlook change at all when you're assessing some critical minerals potential development plays?
Yes, I do believe that the financing risk for critical, especially, let's say, strategic minerals, more so than critical, might have an easier time getting funding. And how you would maybe separate those is those strategic minerals and something that the U.S. wants now, whether it's rare earths or potentially lithium or some of those commodities, they're willing to come in and help fund. Car manufacturers might be willing to come in and fund. Battery manufacturers, cathode manufacturers, all these guys might be willing to come in and fund. I mean, we might see more trading companies coming in to help fund some of these projects. I mean, the world is changing very fast. A signal for me is like Trafigura working with the US and the Europeans on developing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of kilometers of rail from the Central African Copper Belt, in the DRC, to a port in Angola. I think it's called Lobito, such that they can avoid the infrastructure built by the Chinese and they can own the copper and the cobalt. And so that's what's happening in the background. You know, all these deals, bilateral transactions that are happening. And I see, you know, and Biden, you know, heading to Vietnam as well to get, you know, exposure to their manufacturing capacity. You know, they're, you know, they have rare earths, they have nickel as well. So all of this is happening in the background as well. But I can see those companies that are working in these kind of environments potentially having access to more capital, not necessarily Canadian retail, but maybe other, you know, I mean, I was at the Boca Raton conference, Rick Rule's conference, and, you know, one of the stars there was an ionic clay project in Brazil. So, you know, for rare earths, you know, that's the kind of thing that's gaining traction.
Well, Joe, I'd also like to ask you about copper, just because when we talked last time, it was not actually an official U.S. strategic mineral. And then shortly thereafter, it actually got added. We hear all these bullish forecasts for copper, and it makes sense that, you know, you're going to need a lot more copper for the electric grid. You're going to need a lot more copper for EVs. But it seems like there's a lot of projects sitting out there that have very large capex requirements, and they don't seem to be getting a lot of the buzz that, let's say, rare earths, lithium, and nickel are getting in the space, or as much government money. Do you think that's going to change now with it being added to the U.S. as a strategic metal, or what is the future of the copper market?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I'm wondering the same thing. And it might be that difference between what the U.S. calls strategic and critical. And copper just got on the critical mineral list. But at this point, it's not considered strategic like the rare earths, and such that there may not be funding for those projects and even accelerated permitting like we see for some processing facilities. But I know that, you know, Canada itself is, I think, promoting a tax credit, a 30% tax credit for companies that build processing facilities in Canada. And I believe Generation Mining might be able to take advantage of that with their a palladium copper project, Marathon in Northern Ontario. You know, but then for projects like that, you know, that need, you know, over a billion, It's that, you know, they could get maybe 70% in debt and other forms of debt, you know, for the project, but then it's that extra 15 to 20% of equity that they would have to go to the market. That's the last leg of it that seems to be the hardest, even for, you know, these so-called critical minerals.
Yeah, it's so true. Hey, Joe, before we get you out of here, then what are you doing? What are you telling your subscribers about potentially seeing opportunities in the market to put some cash to work, or simply still sitting on the sidelines waiting to see how this unfortunate bear market plays out?
Well, I'm not currently in a fetal position sucking my thumb. I haven't got to that yet. But I must say that there are still a lot of projects of interest out there. And, you know, I'm going to be heading to Chile and Peru because I still see Chile potentially making a rebound. And I'll be looking at exploration and development projects once again in Chile and grassroots exploration projects in Peru. I'm still, you know, a big believer in the copper sector. And so that will be my emphasis right now, because I know the industry is well aware of the shortfalls in production and what they actually can get their hands on. Even in a slow growth scenario, there's a lot of mines that are getting long in tooth. You could see Codelco's production profile in that as a testament to that. So, and then the capital being put into these highly probable projects is getting slower and slower, such that they're not going to be in when people have forecasts that they'll come actually into production. So I think that there's a big room for the copper market and the copper price, and picking the right projects before that happens is basically one of my key goals.
Okay. Joe, thank you very much for taking time, sharing your outlook on the conferences, a nice little recap there, and also how you see these development plays hopefully progressing and which ones actually have a chance of maybe getting some money, at least in the near term. It all comes down to, I think, just a wider range or wider audience to give some of these companies money. And unfortunately, the precious metals, well, they just haven't been in favor for quite a while now. Joe, thank you very much for your time. Everyone, be sure to check out Exploration Insights to follow along with Joe and all the companies he is covering. And Joe, I'm going to try to bring you back on next month. So I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thank you very much, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.